It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, a writer and analyst for MLB.com, joined by MLB.com National Content Editor Matt Myers. On today's show, we're going to go back to something like our regular season format. We're going to start with our opener and talk about Kim Ng and the Marlins as they have hired her to be their general manager. We have our three-batter minimum. We're going to talk a little bit about the Cubs, the Hall of Fame, and Drew Smyly. We're going to be joined by Mandy Bell, who is our Cleveland Indians beat writer. She'll talk to us about Francisco Lindor, Mike Chernoff, Brad Hand, everything about Cleveland. And we will finish off by picking up a couple of random free agents you should know about, and then Matt and I each have a rant. The first thing we need to do is start with our opener. I think this maybe happened right after we recorded last week, so even though it may seem like old news at this point, we never got a chance to talk about the Marlins hiring Kim Ng, which is a, I guess it's an understatement to say, a pretty monumentally historic hire. Obviously the first female to run a pro franchise in the four North American sports. I think in the wake of that part of it, it almost gets lost a little bit that she is also the first Asian American to run a Major League Baseball team, which is also a huge deal. Matt, this is it fair to say, in your opinion, that, you know, not only is this long overdue, because it clearly is, she is probably the most wildly overqualified first-time general manager that you can ever think of?
Almost certainly. in his news conference yesterday, New Angels GM Perry Manassian said this was the first GM job he'd ever interviewed for.
Yeah, that stood out.
And if those have been paying attention, baseball, you know, from starting in like 2005, there was about a run of for about 6 years where it seemed like Kim Ng was being brought in to interview for almost every GM position. I think she was a finalist when Ned Colletti got the Dodgers job. She was the assistant GM for the Dodgers at the time, and this was, what, 2005? So she's worked for the Yankees as AGM, Dodgers AGM. She worked at the commissioner's office for many years. I mean, the resume is obviously that of a extremely, as you said, overqualified candidate.
I was thinking, it's possible if she gets that Dodgers job in 2005, I never become a baseball writer, because a big part of how I ended up starting writing about baseball was being angry about Juan Pierre getting a 5-year contract from the Dodgers, which I don't know if she would have done. But yeah, you're not wrong. She's actually been in the game since 1990. She started out with the White Sox. She was there through 96, then the Yankees for a couple years, and then, as you said, the Dodgers. And since 2011, she has been in the MLB commissioner's office. So she really knows every part of the game. I also thought it was interesting. Our friend and colleague, Darren Willman, who runs BaseballSavant.com, earlier this year, she actually had reached out to him to try to get a little bit more of a crash course on how that works and what all the metrics are. So it's going to be interesting to see what type of general manager she is. I don't feel like she's necessarily, you know, one of the Ivy League stat nerds, but I don't think she's going to be necessarily old school either. So long overdue and very cool. And, you know, obviously I wish this had happened sooner, but I think it's pretty clear she's not going to be the last. You know, this is going to open the door. If you just hear, even on Twitter, I can only imagine what they're saying privately, but all the female beat writers and sports writers, really across sports, are just so excited about this, and for great reason. I mean, this is going to open a lot of doors, and it's important. It really is. And then what I was thinking about as well is, so now she's got a job to do, right? Now she's got to, I don't want to say fix the Marlins, because the Marlins, you know, had a decent year for them. They made the playoffs and they actually beat the Cubs. But I remember as I was doing this study like late in the season, trying to figure out which stats in a short season like correlated best to success, right? And it wasn't batting average. It wasn't really even strikeout rate, but it was mostly like power and home runs. And I kept thinking to myself, well, the Marlins don't rate well on any of this. You know, like they did well, obviously, but they were also only 31 and 29. They wouldn't have made the postseason in a regular size postseason. And, you know, they have been rebuilding for, I don't know, 15 years now at this point, it seems like. The most recent one was when they sent away Stanton and Real Muto and Yelich and Ozuna, and they're starting to see the returns from that. And there's some positive things there, but I almost feel like they were underrated going into the season, and now maybe they're a little overrated. So if you are Kim Heng, where do you start?
It's a really good question. You know, I think that there may not be a team, the Marlins of all the teams from 2020, they might be the toughest to evaluate. Because, you know, they end up sneaking into the playoffs. They beat the Cubs, which was kind of an upset, and there's a lot of good feeling about them. But then they went and got kind of just like waxed by the Braves. You know, they were shut out twice in that series and just like did not look very good. And then you look at the, as you said, sort of look at some of the underlying stats, you know, they were outscored by 41 runs on the season. Now, granted, they did have that one game where they lost by like 25, but even still, if you kind of just like toss that out, it's still not like a good number. The run differential would be about the same as the Mets. So my biggest concern for the Marlins going into this offseason was they were going to sort of believe their own press clippings, that they were going to believe the hype about, oh, that they beat the Cubs and they made a playoff run, and sort of think that they were like ready to go, when I don't think that they are. Now I'm sort of, I'd be love to know sort of what Aang said in her interview that sort of got her the job, because it's a really interesting question, because I'm not even sure. I mean, their starting pitching is pretty good. They've got some interesting young names. Sixto Sanchez is obviously like the big one, but I'm still like, the position player situation is not that inspiring, and the bullpen was legitimately terrible this past year,
right?
One of the worst in baseball. So I mean, like, if you're looking at the NL East for next year, you know, you just did a piece where you looked at every team's projected wins above replacement right now with their current rosters, you know, taking free agents off, and the Marlins ranks 28th out of 30 teams.
Yeah, it's not great. When you look at the offense, I don't mind strikeouts if you're pairing it with power. Like, I don't mind Miguel Sano. I don't mind Joey Gallo. Well, the Marlins had the 9th highest strikeout rate and the 6th lowest slugging percentage. And that's with at least one or two guys playing wildly over their heads. Like Miguel Rojas, their shortstop, who has kind of become the captain of this team, basically. He hit this year 304, 392, 496. That is an OPS plus of 141. That's in 143 games, right? I'm not buying that, because if you look at the previous 1900 plate appearances, he had an OPS plus of 82. Like, I'm not focusing on what he did this year so much, because he is a below average hitter. Doesn't mean there's not talent here. Like, I like Brian Anderson fine. You know, he's solid. He's not a star. Like, you can have him there. I like Jesus Aguiar, but he's not a building block at this point. I like that they picked up the option on Starling Marte, by the way. I think we're talking a lot about teams choosing not to spend and not picking up options. They actually did pick up Marte's, which I think is good. But you're right. I mean, it's not going to be hard to find relievers, I think. And we should probably at least pause to point out and give them credit for the fact that their season got totally exploded by COVID, and they had to pull guys out of absolutely nowhere.
This is true. That's fair point.
So I don't want to be like too hard on them there. But you know, I'm trying to figure out where the offense comes from. I'm kind of over Jorge Alfaro, at least as a starter behind the plate. And they're not going to get Romito, right? But there are catchers out there. You know, you can get a James McCann. You can go get Wilson Ramos, you know, guys like that. I feel like they need at least one outfield bat. So Marte is fine. I'm not convinced, like, some of the guys they got in those trades. Like, is Lewis Brinson ever going to make enough contact? No, right? Now, you can look at like Jazz Chisholm. I like that. Like that was an interesting trade. Although Zach Gallen has been really good for Arizona. And what I'm fascinated by is, even though, you know, Kim Heng has been around for a really long time, we don't know much about her in the sense of what moves that she'll make. And even if we did, I don't think the Marlins are going to run a Dodger size payroll here. So I think they're in a good starting place. I think expectations are probably pretty low, but in terms of where they go and what they do, I'm pretty fascinated here. And as you said, Matt, 28th in terms of current talent. Now, that's just like counting up the war. That's not like the perfect way to do it. But I think it says a little bit about the fact that they overperformed. Like, there's not one guy on offense here, really on the whole team outside of maybe Sixto Sanchez, that I look at and say, that guy's a superstar. Like, that's the guy they build around. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, they have some interesting prospects, as you said. I think Jizom still qualifies. They had JJ Bleday, who was a top 5 pick this year out of Vanderbilt. So presumably, as a college bat, he could move pretty fast. Granted, he didn't really get to play pro ball this year, so that might sort of change the timeline. But you know, I guess, you know, we'll see. It's they're going to be, you know, as far as teams to watch this offseason, I think they're high on the list among the most interesting.
Yeah. Speaking of teams to watch, did you hear about the Cubs? Let's move on into our three batter minimum here. The Cubs have parted ways with Theo Epstein, who has been there since 2011, obviously piloted them to the curse breaking World Series championship in 2016. He has decided to take the upcoming season off. He reportedly is not going to be looking for another job this year, although also reportedly it sounds like the Phillies don't care about that and are still going to try to get him to work there. This isn't so much of a, maybe the timing is a surprise, right? Like, we expected this was going to happen. He's always said he's not going to be there forever. I think we thought it was going to be next year. And the way he put it was basically that he knew he wasn't going to be there. He knew that this team this offseason was going to have a ton of moves to make. And he sort of wanted to make sure that the people who were going to be around for those moves got to make those calls, right? So I think I saw Jed Hoyer received an extension, so he'll be there for a while. Before we get into what the Cubs are going to do, what is your impression of what the Cubs have been, right? Like, when he was hired at the end of 2011 and you were told, okay, 5 years from now, they're getting that ring, I think everybody in Chicago would have been like, great, sign me up. I don't care anything else that happens. And that's true. Like, flags fly forever, right? But I think they were also sort of positioned as being like this young super team, and it never really happened. I mean, the last 3 years have been pretty inconsistent. You know, they didn't make the playoffs in 2019. They just got swept by the Marlins this year. They lost to the Rockies in 2018. Like, how do you view the Theo Epstein Cubs experience?
I think that, you know, it's they won, they broke the curse, so it's a success in that regard, but it left you wanting a little bit more. It definitely felt like they were going to become kind of this like total juggernaut. But he had an interesting quote in his press conference where he said something. He said, if you look at my track record in Boston and here, in the first 6 years, we did some pretty epic things. But then he says that like it actually kind of diminished. And he said, you know, maybe I'm not as motivated by maintenance, which I thought was a really interesting self assessment, because it kind of really rings true. Like, in Boston, they won the two rings, 2004 and 2007. And then they kind of went south. They had that collapse in 2000, I guess, 11, was it? And then he left. And then same thing with the Cubs. He was able to kind of, you know, he like with the Cubs, it was just, you know, rebuild from, you know, from scratch, basically. And they had a lot of high draft picks and turned those into some, you know, they built around, you know, bets, you know, and then it was a success. You know, they got Chris Bryant. He was a star. He won MVP. But then they kind of went all in to win that ring, and they made a couple of trades that really not backfired. Like the Gleyber Torres trade is the big one, right? They traded him to get a role to Chapman, and they won the World Series. You would never regret that trade, but that was a huge price to pay for a half season of a closer. And then the next spring, they traded Eloy Jimenez for Jose Quintana. And again, it was like a huge, and Quintana just like went from being like a good number two starter to just being kind of a guy. He was fine, but he was just not as particularly good for the Cubs. So they paid this huge price in prospects. And at a certain point, they stopped being able to produce these kinds of players. It just felt like they were no longer, the pipeline kind of dried up, and they didn't have, for a while, they had this like crazy, like group of young players, and it just kind of faded away. And then suddenly they didn't have these young guys coming up to fill holes on the roster anymore. And they just didn't seem nearly as intimidating.
Yeah. And so much was made at the end of last year. It's like, okay, Joe Maddon's gone. We're going to bring in David Ross. It's going to be a whole change in atmosphere. And, you know, I wasn't in the clubhouse. Nobody was. Maybe it was. I don't know. Didn't really feel that different, right? Like, the offense still had exactly the same offensive problems. And again, shortened season, you don't want to kill anybody for too much. But, man, you look at Chris Bryant, 206, 293, 351, heading into his final year before free agency. I don't know how you fix this necessarily without moving one of your big name guys. Like, Javi Baez just had a terrible year. Anthony Rizzo is like, okay. Like, the only guy on that team, well, two guys, I guess, who had good offensive years were Ian Happ, who had kind of a nice breakout year, and somewhat surprisingly, Jason Hayward hit pretty well after years of sort of being viewed as a disappointment. But if you look at the depth chart, it's like, you have a hole at second base. Okay, fine. But if you're going to add another bat, you've got to move somebody. You've got to move Bryant, which I don't think they can do or should do. You got to move Schwarber, who was not very good, which I think is fine, but you won't get anything for him. Wilson Contreras? Like, is that your best trade piece? But whatever you do, you got to pick up somebody and trade him. And it's going to be somebody from the core of that team, to say nothing about the fact that after Darvish and after Kyle Hendricks, you probably need another starting pitcher or two right now. You know, like Alzolay, I like a lot. Chatwood's fine. And then I don't know what you do with the fact that the division is like super questionable. You know, the Pirates are, forget that. The Cardinals can't hit, the Reds can't hit, the Brewers can't hit, and the Cubs have problems, which is, I guess, both, you know, it's difficult to say we're not going to try to compete because it's easily winnable. And then also difficult because those teams might also contend as well. I don't envy Jen Hoyer. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, it's, I mean, sometimes I wonder if like the like sort of the savvy move would be to try to sort of undercut the Francisco Lindor market and make Javier Baez available and see if you can turn around and get some good young talent for him. But similar to Bryant, he had a 599 OPS last year. Javi Baez, he was brutal, and so it's I'm not even sure that would really get much for him. So I guess there's the feeling of maybe you kind of run it back with this group, but then you've got Rizzo, Bryant, Baez, and Kyle Schwarber, all free agents next offseason. The Cubs might be entering kind of a dark period. To kind of avoid that, I think Hoyer needs to make some trades right now before the season starts, or else it's going to be like a real significant rebuild.
I agree with you. And that's the one positive thing I'm looking at is I don't think if Jed Hoyer thought that they were going to like blow it up and tank and not compete, that he would sign up to do that. Right. Like he's got enough of a name that he could probably go somewhere else and run some other team. I think he's there to try to win, and whether they can do it, whether ownership allows him to do it, I really don't know, but times are changing in Chicago, to be sure. Okay. Our second topic, the 2021 Hall of Fame ballot was announced earlier today. This is not fair to say. I was going to say not impressive, right?
But it wasn't today for the record. It was earlier this week, but go on.
Sorry. I was going to say the first year guys, it's not right to say not impressive. If you even get to the Hall of Fame ballot, you've had a very good year, right? There's no Derek Jeter on this list. If I look at these list of, that's like 11, I think, first year names, Tim Hudson, Mark Burley, Torrey Hunter, Dan Herron, Barry Zito, Aramis Ramirez, Shane Victorino, AJ Burnett, Nick Swisher, LaTroy Hawkins, Michael Kadire. I have two reactions. The first is, wow, I watched all of those guys play. Wow, I'm old now. That's scary. The second thing is, not only do I not think any of those guys are going to get into the Hall of Fame, I'm not sure any of them reach the 5% minimum to even, you know, be held over to the next year. Is that too aggressive for you?
Yeah, no, I was literally just thinking the same thing. It would not shock me if none of these guys returned for next year. And this might be the weakest sort of like first year ballot that I can remember. You know, there were times during their career where, you know, there was a time during his career where Tim Hudson looked like he might be a Hall of Famer, or Barry Zito looked like he might be a Hall of Famer. As crazy as that is to say now, but those of this group, those are probably the only two that ever had a moment where you're like, oh, this guy might go to the Hall of Fame. Like, even as good as he was, Mark Burley never felt like, there was never like, oh, this guy's going to the Hall of Fame. Same with Torrey Hunter or Dan Herron or Aramis Ramirez, right?
Yeah, Mark Burley was definitely more of a quantity over quality kind of guy. Not that he wasn't good, because he was, but I'm looking at his page now. He got Cy Young votes in exactly 1 year. That's it. And he finished fifth. You know, he was known for working quickly and throwing a lot of innings and being a very good fielder. And that stuff's all valuable for sure. But yeah, there's not a single one of these guys that I think would actually get a vote for me. And so that means there are 14 remaining players on the list. The most interesting are the three from last year who got the highest percentage of votes. So you need to get 75% to get in, and you have 10 years in which to do it. Well, the top three guys last year, Curt Schilling, who got 70%, Roger Clemens, who got 61%, and Barry Bonds, who got just under 61%, are all in, I guess, their ninth year on the ballot now. So they are kind of nearing the end of the line. Now, normally, I would say if you get 70% of the ballot, like Schilling did, and if you were in a weak ballot, which he is, you're probably a shoo-in, and maybe he is. I think it's also pretty fair to say that the reason he is not in yet is because of everything he has said, both horrible and offensive on social media in so many different ways. I think he has permanently lost a lot of votes there, and I can't really argue with any of that. I think it's pretty clear, regardless of how you feel about Clemens or Bonds, that they are not going to get in at this point. I'd be very surprised if that happens. And I remain completely confused by the support for Omar Vizquel, who got 52.6% last year. obviously a very good fielder, a very below average hitter, and I think probably an overrated fielder. I don't think I would be disappointed necessarily if none of these guys got in. Like, if I had a ballot and I don't yet, I'd probably pick six, right? I would vote for Scott Rolen. I would vote for Billy Wagner. I would consider Jeff Kent and Andrew Jones and Todd Helton and maybe Manny Ramirez. But it's very different from years past where it's like, oh yeah, Mariano Rivera is getting in. Ken Griffey Jr. is totally getting in. Like, we don't have that this year.
2 points on that. One of which you didn't even mention before I get to Fiscal. You didn't even mention my sort of like guy on this ballot, which is Bobby Abreu, who has a way better case than he's giving credit for.
He's got no shot.
Here's a great Bobby Abreu stat that I saw tweeted by Jeremy Frank at MLB Random Stats. Bobby Abreu reached base safely more times in his career than Tony Gwynn and had 150 more extra base hits and 80 more stolen bases in basically the exact same number of games. So Bobby Abreu is maybe the most underrated player of my lifetime. He was so good. Some of his seasons, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. I'm a broken record on Bobby Abreu, but it's like, it is wild how good he was and just sort of how he got kind of totally overlooked for how good he was. Like just to give you an example, the 2003 season, even better was 2004. 301, 428, 544 with 30 home runs and 40 stolen bases. And he finished 23rd in MVP voting.
23rd?
I mean, so this is like one of those things where you talk about how MVP votes affect how you're perceived in your career.
Yeah.
Like that's a perfect example. Getting back to Vizquel for a second, I used to be one of these I used to get in the weeds on these flame wars on Twitter and before that Baseball Think Factory for all you old school baseball nerds on here about Hall of Fame and who deserved it and what the bar is. Like, I've softened in my old age. Like, it's cool when guys get in, and I think the players from modern era are generally underrepresented. And I know, Mike, you're doing some research on that. I don't know if you've completed it, but you're going to write about it, so I won't go. But it's players from 1960 on are way underrepresented in the Hall of Fame compared to players born in the 1910s. And I think that it's okay if we start electing a lot more players from the 90s and 2000s, even in addition to the influx we've seen in the last few years. So Omar Vizquel, he had this reputation for kind of being the Ozzie Smith of the 90s. I don't think he was, but if he gets in the Hall of Fame, okay. But as an example, we just, our MLB.com beat reporters just did a story where they each did the top five players from their franchise not in the Hall of Fame. And Vizquel wasn't even the number one pick for the Indians, written by Manny Bell. He wasn't even number two. He was the number three pick. Kenny Lofton and Manny Ramirez were ahead of him, which I think
I will go to the wall for Kenny Lofton. Yes, absolutely.
Exactly.
He was a one and done guy, wasn't he?
So it's I'm going down this list and I'm like, you know what? Omar Vizquel, sure, maybe he should be in the Hall of Fame, but so should Dave Steeb and Fred McGriff and Kenny Lofton and Lou Whitaker and Bobby Gritch and Lance Berkman and Mark McGwire and Adrian.
Right.
It's and on and on and on. So it's kind of I'd open the door for Omar Vizquel, but it seems like if we're kind of getting people in line, I think he's kind of, to me, he's at the back of the line.
I have, I think, five more years before I get a ballot. What are you at? Seven more years? You're a little behind me.
Yeah.
I can't believe they're actually going to let us vote for these things one day. It'll be fine in a year or two to really have a good idea of who is retired and who might be on those first ballots. All right. So those will be announced at the end of January. It would not shock me very much if nobody gets in at all. The final thing in our three batter minimum to start off our show. Were you surprised, because everybody was surprised, that Drew Smyly got an 11 million.
11 year. Yes, I was surprised by his 11
years. Is that more surprising? Here's Drew Smyly for you. He was a second round pick of the Tigers back in 2010, I believe. Yes, 2010. He got traded for David Price in a David Price deal. He got traded in a deal for Ryan Yarbrough. He got traded for the right to not have to pay Cole Hamels his buyout. He injured his shoulder. He had labrum surgery. He injured his elbow. He had Tommy John surgery. He has bounced around a lot and never really been healthy and productive enough at the same time. He has not thrown over 100 innings with an ERA plus over 100. So basically a season where he was above average and healthy enough to throw 100 innings since 2014, which is the only time he did it. And now he's got a 1-year deal worth $11 million. And I think comparing that with the fact that Brad Hand, who's been a very good reliever for the last couple of years, was not given a $10 million deal from Cleveland, I think really threw a lot of people. And I think this tells you a little bit about what baseball teams are looking for now. So it's true. If you were to look at the entirety of Smiley's career, not so great, right? But if you were to look at what he did last year, so in 2019, stepping back for a second, played for the Rangers and the Phillies, it was not good. A 6.24 ERA, gave up 2.5 home runs per nine. And then he goes to the Giants, and again, he got hurt. He hurt his finger. He missed half the season. So he only threw 26 and a third innings in the first place. But if you were to look at the end of his season, he made four starts in September. And I know we're talking about the tiniest of tiny samples here. They were really good. If you look at those four starts, 31 strikeouts, five walks. His velocity was up by a couple ticks. If you look at his strikeout percentage and you put the minimums, you know, down to 25 innings, he had like a top 10 strikeout rate. Meanwhile, Brad Hand, who's been good for a couple of years, velocity is down. You know, his ground ball rate is down. I think even though he was just a good pitcher and he's still a good pitcher, teams are afraid of that. And so they're hoping to pay for like the next big thing in Smiley. And they don't want to pay for maybe a declining guy in Hand, even though I think that's a little bit too soon for him. So I get what the Braves are doing here. But I think this was a hard one for a lot of people to swallow.
I think, you know, having watched the postseason, what it says to me is just like, you know, after watching, actually not just the postseason, this whole season, teams are just desperate for starting pitching. And I think that's kind of why you're going to see the market for these mid-tier starters might be pretty reasonable this offseason, at least from a player perspective. You know, we already saw Robbie Ray get a one-year, $8 million deal, which is also a surprise from people. He's signed with the Blue Jays. Because, I mean, by the time the postseason rolled around, no one had it. Even the good teams were desperate for starts. And it was kind of that story all offseason. So I think there's a lot of questions about, you know, coming off this 60-game season, are pitchers going to be able to bounce back and be, you know, go and pitch even 150, let alone 200 innings in 2021? So starting pitching depth is going to be really, really valuable. So I think we're seeing teams kind of snatch up these players who I think might be sort of like undervalued as starters if they think they see something that they can kind of get more out of. And so I think the pitchers kind of in that class, you know, maybe your Jake Odorizzi's, your Jay Happ's, that, you know, your Jeff Samardzija's, that class of pitcher might end up doing pretty well just because teams are kind of like desperate for guys who they know can give them like, you know, some half decent innings.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that sort of leads into a bigger thing is that the league leader this year in innings pitched was Lance Lynn with 84. I think only 17 guys got to 70, right? And if we have a full season next year and you're going to try to get up to 180 innings, what does that do to these guys who aren't necessarily built up for that? So I think you're right. Like, you don't necessarily need a guy that you can count on for 200 good innings. Like, if you get 70 good innings out of Drew Smiley, like, are you okay with that? I mean, I guess you have to be, because if he was better than that, he'd get more than 1 year. It is interesting to see the Braves kind of jumping up on the starting pitching market again, right? Because they signed Tomlin. I think they did this last year. Didn't they get, who did they get? Will Smith, right? A couple other guys that they'd already had that they re-signed. And I think the Braves, even though they're the multiple time defending champions in the East, probably still need a pitcher. Like, I had picked Charlie Morton to go there, and I still think they should go get Charlie Morton. Like, I don't think Drew Smiley solves your problems. I think he maybe helps your problems. But it is kind of fun to see when we all expect this winter to be maybe a tight one, and maybe it still will be. But then I see Drew Smiley getting $11 million, and I guess the answer is I don't know why we try to predict baseball, because who even knows? So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be joined by our guest, Mandy Bell, who is the MLB.com Cleveland Indians beat writer. She will talk to us about all things Cleveland. We'll be right back.
Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about. With a real healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication, it's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/MLB and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/MLB today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of ED treatment. Roman is the official partner of Major League Baseball. That's GetRoman.com/MLB. GetRoman.com/MLB.
Welcome back to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I'm Mike Petriello, joined by Matt Myers, and we are joined by a special guest today, Mandy Bell, who is our MLB.com Cleveland Indians beat writer. The Indians, I think, are somewhat of a focal point of the offseason because there's going to be rumors swirling around Francisco Lindor. They non-tendered or chose not to pick up the option on Brad Hand. There's just a lot of interesting topics around the Indians, and we're going to ask about all of them. But first, Mandy, before we brought you on here, we spent a little bit of time talking about the Marlins and hiring Kim Ng. And we were curious. I imagine you've talked to some of your female colleagues across the sport, and I imagine the reaction here has been overwhelmingly positive. But I was hoping you could share a little bit with us about what you've heard.
Oh, I mean, I don't think there's any way to describe it, but extremely positive. It's so exciting because it's tough to see somebody who was so qualified for so long and to see how long that she kept grinding. I mean, it was not just tough, but it's an inspiration to see how she did that and to show that anything is possible for anyone in this field. And I know anyone who follows me on Twitter knows how close I am with Sarah Langs, part of our research team. And as the second it happened, we texted each other and it was all caps, so excited. So, I mean, I think it's so cool and it's so exciting. And I could not commend the Marlins more for making that decision, because this is a big step, and I think there's way more to come now.
Yeah, as we said earlier before you joined us, hopefully the first of several more to follow, and hopefully sooner than later. So now getting to the Indians, I guess there's no better way to ask this question than, is this the year he gets traded, Lindor? I feel like we've been talking about this for like three solid years, and it never seems to happen. And I've actually got some opinions on why it might not happen. But first, please tell us, is this actually the year it happens?
I mean, everything inside of me wants to say yes, but then every time I start to think about where he could go, how it could happen, what they could get in return after this year, everything that every team has to deal with right now because of COVID and not sure with next season, part of me is like, well, maybe not. But it just seems like it has to, because this is how the Indians have to work. They constantly mention, we've let people stay out their entire time here, and we don't always have to trade people away, but they sort of do. And that's just sort of how they have to do it, because that's the way that they continue to try to avoid a rebuilding phase. And whenever they avoid the rebuilding phase, you have to get rid of some top guys to be able to get some great prospects and great players in return to keep the major league team as strong as possible. So they need outfield help. And it seems weird to say they need outfield help when they have 5,000 outfielders on their roster, because they ran out so many different combinations last year. There's so many things going on in that outfield. But nothing's working, which is making it difficult. And they know that. And you can see that with how many combinations of outfielders they tried. So I think that's going to be a big thing. And then they just need hitting. They need something in that lineup.
Have you ever hit on a sweet spot here in terms of us talking about how the Indians need outfielders? I think that's been something we've been talking about for what, like 3 years at least. So, I mean, on that topic, you know, obviously they haven't gone out and, you know, spent huge money on Harper or anything. And pretty clearly there are intelligent people running this team. What do you think has happened in the outfield? Is it that they've had higher hopes for some of these guys that didn't pan out, or they sort of knew what they were getting and figured between Ramirez and Lindor and that pitching staff, it wouldn't matter so much? Like, how much of this has been expected versus not expected in terms of that outfield?
Yeah, it's weird because you see the way that their pitching has been developed over the last few years. It's, I mean, mind-blowing to see the way that these young pitchers have just stepped up and been amazing, but it just hasn't been the same whenever you start to look in the outfield. And it's like they've had high hopes for some of these guys and it hasn't panned out. And you know, you have the Jordan Luplos of the world where you tried to make a trade there and different things like that. It just seems like that's just the area that they've just been trying to piece together and hope that they could just get by. And last year we saw how difficult that was.
They got an outfielder in the Mike Clevinger trade. They got Josh Naylor. And I was not super optimistic about this trade in the sense that Naylor hadn't really done much with the Padres. And then he didn't really do much with the Indians. You know, with the Indians, he had a 52 OPS plus, where 100 is league average, 85 for his career. And then in the playoffs, I know it's only two games, right? But he had those two games against the Yankees, 5 hits, 4 for extra bases. He looked like the best player on the field. And I feel like I ought to know enough to not put any emphasis on literally two games. And I know the people running teams won't. But do you think, like, internally that has changed his perception at all, just based on what he did?
I mean, I think it's tough to ignore what he did. And I think the biggest thing that everyone saw during that stretch was the passion that he had. Like, it was fun to watch him play during those two games because he was just living and dying with every single thing that was going on. And I think that fueled him. And to see that in there, I mean, I never like to say that it didn't seem like they had that spark. Maybe they didn't have the energy, because you know that these guys are going there every single day with the goal of winning, but it just seemed like they needed something. And he seemed like that he could be that spark moving forward with just the energy that he brought. And I think that the bat, the way that showed up in the postseason, can only build confidence going forward.
I want to get back to Lindor for a second, because as you might have seen on MLB.com this week, some of our staff members put together some fake trades, and I love me a good fake trade. And I'm curious if you saw any of them, and if any of the teams that were listed seem like better fits than others. Just to give a quick rundown of the teams that were mentioned in some form, we had the Blue Jays, the Phillies, the Mets, the Reds, the Yankees, the Cardinals, even the Dodgers. Are there any teams in there that you think are more likely destinations for Lindor?
Ah, man. I mean, the Mets had been on my mind since the beginning of the offseason. With new ownership, it just seemed like they would be ready to go out and that seems like the team that the Indians want to target right now, because it's tough. It's tough to know who's going to be able to give up what they're looking for, what teams can afford right now. And with this new ownership, maybe that's what you need to take advantage of, and a go-getter like that type of a mindset right now. But I don't know if the Mets would want to just focus on focusing all of their attention on a big trade like that. Maybe they just want to focus all of their attention on going after some of the big free agents. I mean, there's big free agents out there right now. You have Real Muto, you have Bauer, you have Springer, you have big guys that are out there right now. So I don't know. I think that at least they have some outfielders that would be interesting for the Indians to look into. I think that even just the prospect of Pete Crow Armstrong, I think that even, I know it's down the line, but that's what the Indians are best at. They somehow find these guys that everyone's like, why'd you make this trade? And whenever it ends up panning out, then it really, down the line, you can look back on it and be like, wow, this actually did work out. So I still want to stick with them. I'm not 100% positive that would be my final answer in a couple weeks, because it seems like everything in 2020, everything changes by the day. So, but if you're asking me today, I'm still going to stick with the Mets. I think that I like the best.
You make a good point about whether or not they'd want to give up a lot for Lindor right now, I think, because, you know, next offseason, there are a bunch of free agent shortstops available. Lindor, Trevor Story, Carlos Correa, Corey Seager, Javier Baez. You could see a world where the Mets or any team is like, well, why should I trade for Lindor now? I should just try and get by for a year, and then I could sort of, you know, get one in the free agent market. But speaking of the Mets, our colleague John Paul Morosi was reporting this morning that Indians GM Mike Chernoff is the leading contender to be the Mets' new head of baseball operations. Right now, he's the GM with the Indians, right under Chris Antonetti, who's the president of baseball operations. So this would be a promotion for him. What are you hearing on that front? And do you think if he did take the job, do you think that would make a Lindor trade more likely or less likely to the Mets?
Yeah, I started thinking about that. And I was like, I mean, it would make sense if it could make it more likely. That would be my guess. But I guess I could see it in the opposite way. The Indians are very, very quiet on things. And that's, their front office has always been known for that. And they like to keep things very tight. And I do think that, though, they've proven over the years that they would allow their everyone in their front office members, as good as they are, and as close-knit as that group is, to take advantage of opportunities when they're presented. And I don't see them saying, no, you can't have this interview. You can't go through this process and see how it works. I think that they would be open. I think Chernoff would be open to it. Obviously, it's a promotion. It's a big deal. He has roots in New York. I mean, it all seems to make sense. Will it actually happen? I'm not sure. His relationship with Antonetti is unbelievable. They are so close. But personally, I mean, I don't see why he wouldn't at least go through the process and see how it goes.
I think it's fair to say, obviously, it's, you know, very early in the postseason, clearly. But the most, the move that garnered the most controversy was maybe the Indians choosing not to retain Brad Hand, who, you know, had a 2.05 ERA last year. 34% strikeout rate has been very good for the last couple of years. And a $10 million, you know, contract, which is what he would have been due for 2021, does not seem out of line for a guy who's been that successful. And I think pretty clearly people sort of pointed to their comments about tightening the belt and maybe reducing payroll. And that's all, you know, certainly understandable. I'm wondering how much of that you think was just because of the dollars. And if you think there was anything to the idea that maybe despite his fancy surface numbers, there's a little bit of decline coming. So, for example, his fastball velocity used to be like 93, 94. It was down to 91 last year. Slider velocity was down like 6 miles an hour since 2016. Even his ground ball rate used to be like 45%. Now it's 27%. He still struck out a third of the guys he faced and only walked four guys. So I'm not saying he's not good. But how much of that do you put into a baseball decision versus just strictly a payroll decision?
I mean, a lot of it's payroll. Everyone, at least Indians fans, knew this was coming. It was funny to see the national baseball response to it and just the sheer shock of it, because Cleveland was like, why is this shocking? Everyone knew this was coming. it's a lot of payroll, because they've said we've lost tens of millions of dollars this year and we need to tighten this up. But I do think that having James Karinchak there is huge for them. They want this roster to be young and affordable, controllable. I think that they would lean more towards that. Having Emmanuel Clase come back next year, I think that gives them some comfort to have an extra depth piece to maybe move Karinchak out of his role into a closer's position. I think a lot of it goes into it. So I just think that they thought they have solid options that they have right now, and nothing against Brad in the season that he had, but they need to cut their payroll down as much as possible, and they had options to replace him.
Yeah, I think it's fair. And by the way, I'm so glad you brought up James Karinchak, who is always one of my favorites to watch. I think it's fair if they're going to improve next year, especially if they trade Lindor, and obviously not knowing what they might get back, they're going to have to find some amount of offensive improvement. So I want to give you a couple of names of hitters on this team who disappointed this year, because it's hard to know how much to put into a weird shortened 2020, right? So you had Tyler Naquin, who had a 68 OPS plus, Roberto Perez, 33, and Oscar Mercado, -5, which somehow is possible. Of those three guys, which do you think is the best bet to actually come back and produce offensively? We know Perez is a very good catcher, but with the bat.
Oscar Mercado. That's my early guess right now. I think that his rookie season wasn't a fluke. I think he has a lot of potential offensively. I think that he battled the conditions of 2020. I think a lot of players did. I mean, you even saw Lindor not have a Lindor type of season, which is as rare as it gets. So I think that he struggled with it. He never was able to have time to bounce back, find his footing. He got sent down, which killed the confidence. I think everything accumulated for him. And the Indians already talked about how whenever they talked to him at his end of the year meeting before the he left for the offseason, that they felt really, really strong about his offseason goals and plans to get back. So that's my best bet, is that he will have a bounce back year.
Now, the Brad Hand decision was not the only sort of controversial transaction the Indians have made in the last couple of months. I think towards the end of the season, right before the trade deadline, they traded Mike Clevinger to the Padres for a trade return that was deemed, I think, by most people to be a little bit light. It felt like they'd given up, you know, a front of the rotation starter for a package that was just, you know, okay, and that they kind of maybe didn't get enough for him. we've since found out now that Clevinger is going to miss the entire 2021 season because of Tommy John surgery. How much do we kind of reevaluate that trade now? And do you think the Indians, I mean, not that they knew he was hurt, but they maybe had concerns about, you know, his long-term durability, and that they sort of traded him at a time when they felt like they could max. At that point, it was sort of like, if we don't trade him now, who knows where this is going to go?
Yeah, I mean, as questionable as some of their decisions end up looking, they keep proving to at least give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, at least early on when people keep scratching their heads saying, what is going on? I'm sure that they had an idea behind the scenes of what he's been going through. He's had injuries the last few years. He's been struggling to bounce back and stay healthy. So I'm sure that was part of it. We all know that the Chicago incident of him breaking team rules didn't help with how the camaraderie was in the clubhouse and everything. So I'm sure that sped up the process. I think their goal was to at least get him by this offseason, trade him by this offseason. And I think that they ended up hitting it at the perfect time by ending up doing it at the trade deadline. And I think everyone just has to remember that it's tough to see Indians trades as wins right away, because so many of their trades end up with prospects in them. And that's exactly what happened when they got Clevinger in the first place. I mean, you start trading people like with Corey Kluber, and you just trade for like these random minor leaguers, and everyone's like, what are you doing? And then they turn into Corey Kluber and Mike Clevinger. And so it's tough to rule whether or not they win trades right away with this team, because it always pans out over a few years. But I definitely think the timing could not be more perfect now, especially hindsight 2020, with everything that he's about to have to go through again.
Mandy, I think it's safe to say that you, maybe amongst all of our beat writers, are going to have a very interesting offseason. Your team may lose the general manager. They may trade the face of the franchise. And I can't wait to see how it goes. Thank you so much for joining us. Everybody, please follow Mandy at MandyBell02 on Twitter. She is our Cleveland Indians beat writer. We will be right back with more on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast.
This past year has shown us that without your health, you have nothing. If you're not well, you can't work, look after yourself, or take care of your family. You can't enjoy the life you've worked so hard to build. That's why you need to prioritize taking care of your long-term health today, before it goes from good to bad to worse. So invest in your long-term health with Forward. Forward is intelligent medicine with a personal touch. Their doctors are dedicated to catching top killers like cancer and heart disease early, before it's too late. And catching them early could save you tens of thousands of dollars in the long run. Everyone's health history is different, which is why Forward doctors personalize a health plan with you, based on your genetics, lifestyle, and biometrics, to achieve long-term results and ensure nothing gets missed. It's time to invest in a doctor that's invested in you. Go to GoForward.com today to protect your future health. That's GoForward.com. GoForward.com.
Welcome back to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Our thanks to Mandy Bell. We're going to finish off by going to a random, well, usually we do a random player you should know more about. And as Matt made fun of me for all season long, I would inevitably pick some reliever who had pitched like four innings and struck out 12 guys. But since it's the offseason, that's less interesting. There's no more games being played. We're going to start off at least with a random free agent you should know about. We're not going to talk about Trevor Bauer here because everybody knows he's going to be good, George Springer. We're going to go down into maybe the second, third, fourth tier of the free agent list. And Matt, once I saw who you picked, I was actually kind of jealous I didn't pick him, because I think this is a great pick.
My guy is Cesar Hernandez, the second baseman who played most recently for the Indians this past year. And, you know, it kind of goes to what Mandy Bell was saying about how the Indians are kind of very good at kind of finding value. They did a great job with Hernandez, who's been a very like consistent, good player going back a few years now. Not a star, but like, you know, he's a switch hitter with no pronounced platoon split, which I think has a lot of value in terms of just kind of balancing out your lineup. And you look at his numbers, it's just like, it's always about the same. You go back to 2016, his weighted on base average, 335, 346, 320, 315, 335. So he's just a known-ish he's a known quantity. He's entering his age 31 season, so he's not that old. And, you know, you see a lot of conversation about DJ LeMahieu, rightfully so. He's the best second baseman on the market. He's going to get a big deal. And then there's been a lot of conversation about Colton Wong because the Cardinals didn't pick up his option and he's gotten a lot of publicity. I think, and then there's also Jonathan Villar, but I think I'd rather have Hernandez over Wong or Villar. You know, Wong has got that big platoon split. Villar has been up and down his whole career. Hernandez being a switch hitter, I just really like him as a player. He's a very well-rounded player.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. I think that is a perfect choice. I think whoever gets him is going to be pretty happy. My guy's a little different because he's a guy who has fallen upon hard times, whereas I think Hernandez is generally pretty consistent. Jake Lamb is not. There was a time where it seemed like he and Paul Goldschmidt would be, you know, the opposite corners of that Arizona infield for years to come. In 2016, hit 29 home runs. In 2017, he hit 30 home runs. And then he's been injured. You know, the last couple of years have really not been very good. In 2019 and 2020, he had identical 193 batting averages, which is bad. So you might be wondering, why do I care about him? Well, he got off to a really just wretchedly bad start with Arizona this year. Hit 116, 240, 140 in 50 plate appearances. And they kind of moved on from him. He went to Oakland and filled in a bit at third base after Matt Chapman got hurt. He was great. And I'm not trying to put too much on 49 plate appearances because I know that's not necessarily what we're going to care about here. But if you look at the underlying metrics, even over the last couple of years, look at his hard hit rate, right? Over the last 4 years, 36, 38, 43, 51. He had a 51% hard hit rate this year, which if you'd held it up over a full season would be elite. Obviously, this is not a full season. He did it without increasing his strikeout rate. And he's kind of been the same like platoon guy he's always been. Like even going back to his good days with Arizona, if you look at his career, just like a total inability to hit lefties. He's like a 50 OPS plus, and he's pretty strong against righties. But what I like about him is it's not easy to find a half decent lefty hitter who can play some third base. Like I wouldn't sign him to be my starting third baseman, but if you have him as like a first base, third base, you know, backup platoon player kind of type, I'm thinking of like the Phillies, you know, where Rhys Hoskins is a right-handed hitting first baseman and Alec Baum is a right-handed hitting third baseman who's probably not that great of a defender, or a team like that. I think there's still life in Jake Lamb. So how about that? There's a guy.
That's a good one. Also, because the market for third baseman this year is really awful, really weak. You know, Justin Turner, we've talked about almost certainly going back to the Dodgers. And then you're looking at Todd Frazier, Eric Sogard, Marwin Gonzalez, Brock Holt. I think I might like Jake Lamb more than any of those guys. Maybe not Marwin, just because he's a little more versatile. But I think I take him over Sogard and Frazier. Just, but you know, your mileage may vary, of course. But I was a longtime believer in Jake Lamb in on my fantasy baseball team. He was on my roster a couple of years, so I think maybe I'm still holding out hope that he'll make me look smart. So sure, Jake Lamb.
We're going to finish off with our purpose pitch here, where we each have a rant, and I'm going to go with mine. And I want to preface this. I'm going to refer to a tweet by Fred Lynn, but this has nothing to do with Fred Lynn. I've seen this take many times, and he just happens to be the one that I saw this morning. So Fred Lynn, if you're listening, and I hope you are, please come on our podcast. Nothing personal here. So when Theo Epstein left the Cubs, he said something interesting. He mentioned that in part due to executives like himself, like really ushered in this, you know, analytics revolution, that maybe we've lost some of the aesthetics of the game as we've tried to over-optimize it and there's not enough balls in play and he'd like to help fix that. And great. I completely and totally agree with that. There's no question about that. But of course, whenever, a quote unquote nerd says something like that, the traditionalists take it as you ruin baseball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what Fred Lynn said is that, well, where would guys like Rod Carew and Tony Gwynn and Pete Rose fit into today's metrics? Would they have any value because they're singles hitters? And again, nothing about Fred Lynn. I've seen this a lot. And every time I see that quote, it makes my head kind of want to explode because, yeah, those guys got singles and high batting averages. But Rod Carew had like a 393 career on base percentage and a 131 OPS plus. You know, Pete Rose, I don't care about the number of hits he had, but he regularly had on base percentages over 400 while playing all over the field. Tony Gwynn was at times a slugger. He slugged over 500 four different times. Tony Gwynn had a 388 on base percentage, a 132 OPS plus. Tony Gwynn would be a Hall of Famer in any era. And let me also add this about Tony Gwynn. He famously in the 80s was one of the first guys to start using video. Can you imagine Tony Gwynn with full access to the data we have today? get out of here with this. Tony, these guys are always going to be great.
This was part of my excitement about Luis Arraez, was to like to have like a player with like a different profile who could find a different way to be valuable. Because yes, I agree with what Epstein said about some of the aesthetics of the game, and that like too many players are sort of coming in with the same, you know, approach. And that, so it's always fun when you see different players who are able to get the same type of production, but do it a different way. And that was my excitement about Luis Arraez, that like, I thought that he was the kind of guy who could be a, you know, your classic kind of like 1980s singles hitter with a high OBP and put up, you know, a weighted runs created plus of 130 without hitting home runs. All right. My purpose pitch, my rant to close this is really silly and pedantic, but I'm going with it anyway.
Yes. Yes.
When Jose Abreu won AL MVP, I saw this, just, it just brought one of my pet peeves to light. I kept seeing him referred to as a former rookie of the year, and I cannot stand that. He's not a former rookie of the year. He will always be the 2014 American League Rookie of the Year. And we in the sports discourse need to acknowledge this. Stop saying a former first round pick, a former MVP. He, you know, Bryce Harper will always be the number one pick in the 2010 draft. He's not a former number one pick. He is a number one pick. That's my rant.
Yeah, you certainly nailed pedantic on that one.
Hey, I'm nothing if not self-aware.
I guess that works because it's something you are given and not elected to, right? Like, you could be elected president, but then at a certain point you are no longer president, and then you are a former president, I guess. I'm trying really hard on this one here.
I think it provides some context. It's like, it's needed context, right? It's like when you say, my question, because when you say Jose Abreu is former MVP, former rookie of the year, it's like, well, what year? Like, tell me. You could say the 2014 AL rookie of the year. Okay, thank you. Now I know. You know, it's just, I almost feel like it's kind of lazy. It's like saying, like, I can't even be bothered to look up what year he won. I'm just going to write, I know he won it. I'm not even going to be bothered. I'm just going to write, former rookie of the year. Look it up.
Does that count for like all-star games? Do I have to go back and say he's a six-time all-star and that was in 2009 and 2010?
No, I think if you say six-time all-star, you're giving me some context. You're not going to say, oh, a former all-star, right?
That was definitely a take. I will give you that.
I did preface it by saying stupid and pedantic. So you were all warned.
Accurately previewed. I will give you that. That is our show for this week. Thanks again to Mandy Bell. We will be back next week with one show before the Thanksgiving holiday. This is the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Thanks for listening.